In 1960, Kranz joined the NASA Space Task Group at Langley, Virginia, as a flight controller on Project Mercury. He served as flight director for the 33 missions of Projects Gemini, Apollo, and Skylab, and led the flight control team during the first lunar landing. Kranz retired from NASA in 1994 after 37 years in federal service and is currently a consultant and speaker. The hit film Apollo 13 chronicles Kranz's struggle to devise a plan that would safely bring the ship and its crew of three astronauts home after its oxygen system failed. Actor Ed Harris portrayed Kranz in the film, which was directed by Ron Howard. After retirement, Kranz served as a flight engineer on a B-17 Flying Fortress, constructed an aerobatic biplane, and published the New York Times best-selling memoir about his experiences in the space program. His book, Failure is Not an Option, Mission Control from Mercury to Apollo 13 and Beyond, which is available in our bookstore, has been selected by the History Channel as the basis for a documentary on mission control. Please welcome Gene Kranz.
Yes. improvements on the ferry deck. The coast signs of our little flat. Lights up.
Shit.
Serial numbers 1 and serial number 2 of the IBM 7090 series, the first fully solid-state machine ever produced by IBM. And then the advent of Bermuda, we put a reliable vacuum tube computer with a small team of five controllers. We always launched eastward over the island, such that we lost communications with our crew during powered flight. The controllers at that station would tell the astronauts what to do when the engine shut down. Our global communications consisted of a 60-word per minute teletype network that dated back to the days of America's Pony Express. We were flying a spacecraft moving 5 miles per second with a communication system that could crank out 60 words per minute. So with only a couple weeks training in spacecraft systems and operation, and after we all became proficient in Morse code, we sent young men to 13 tracking stations around the world. They went into the heart of Africa, they went to Zanzibar and Australia, ships at sea and islands in the Pacific. These were sites that were literally at the ends of the earth, and the risk of these young people was very high because the 60s was the end of the European colonial period. Many of these countries were in a state of civil war. My controllers in Africa were twice rescued by the army. At Zanzibar, we'd go to work under the protection of the Queen's Royal Rifles, or Gordon Howland Regiment would surround the tracking station during contact periods, bring the controllers back to the quarters and station gunners in the hallways. But these young people at the tracking stations were eyes, their ears, and voices as the spacecraft passed overhead. And through their age, they were given incredible responsibilities, and they grew to be the leaders of Project Apollo. Every first mentioned in the space and Project Mercury, each one of our launches was a chapter in the history of spaceflight. All our mistakes were vile, they were brutal, visible. Two of our first three Atlas rockets exploded shortly after we left the launch pad. Then we launched our first Redstone rocket. We sent the firing command, the engine ignited, lifted 4 inches off the pad, and then the engine shut down. It's what I call a 4-inch flight. Through some miracle, this rocket landed back up right in the launch stand. The escape tire fired, went up to about 4,000 feet, and then came plummeting down at the viewing stand, and the senators and congressmen ran for cover. Our rocket engineers were speaking in German. We didn't understand what they were saying. We literally did not know what to do. But we were fortunate in those days because our nation understood there is no achievement without risk. And there certainly weren't any guarantees in this new business that we call spaceflight. We put 6 Americans in space in our first 2 years. There were close calls on every one of those missions, especially in John Glenn's and Scotty Carpenter's. But we got every one of our crewmen back. And by the time that we had finished with Project Mercury, we had learned that man could live and could perform in space, but we learned much more. We learned that leaders and leadership. Leaders must have integrity. Leaders are team builders, they're teachers. When there's trouble, they step forward, they set the example. They master the chaos that exists in our work. And we also learned a lot about ourselves as individuals, because in those days, most of us came in from aircraft flight tests, and our egos were much bigger than this room. It was really tough to get people to work together at times. But we knew that success would only come as a team, so we became one. And we learned to check our ego at the door every day. So we moved into Project Gemini. Gemini was designed to develop and test and prove the technologies we needed in order to go to the moon. One of these technologies was associated with the tools and the techniques we used in designing our mission trajectories. Now for Project Mercury, for trajectory design, we had a very large group of women. There are about 100 in number. We called the women computers. Computers were people to us in the early days, not machines. They traveled with us from our headquarters at Langley Field in Virginia down to the Cape for every one of the launches. And we provided them calculators. If they were lucky, they got electric models. They'd punch away at the numbers all day long. They'd write the answer down. They would plot it in graph paper. These women would do this endlessly day after day just to design a single Mercury trajectory. Well, this approach wasn't going to get us to the moon. It wouldn't even get 2 spacecrafts around the moon in Gemini. So we finally did get computers, and each one of these machines was as big as a room. 5 of them filled the entire first floor in the mission control in Houston. And they would put a small 4,000-word computer on board the Gemini spacecraft. But the problem was, we had no computer experience. So we went to the colleges and universities of our nation and
brought in the young people who were working with computers and laboratories. We elected the Army Missile Command at Fort Bliss in Texas and brought in the corporals and sergeants when they were discharged because the Army had been working with computers and had granted their missile program. And we took these new recruits and merged them with the Mercury veterans. And we started working with various all knowledge, all technology, and all experience. Now, when I first started off in space, the Soviet Union had about a 2.5 year lead on us. But when Ed White stepped outside of his spacecraft on the Gemini 4 mission, we had now narrowed that lead down to mere months. And then, on the next two missions, for the first time, we set American manned spaceflight records. First for mission duration, and then we rounded it to spacecrafts. And when we had accomplished this round, we had developed technology that we needed to reach further into space. And we had the confidence to use these technologies, but we continued to learn of ourselves and our work. We learned the discipline and absolute unwavering focus upon the objective that was so intense that we would never do anything that would compromise our mission. And we also found the value of high morale because we now knew we were succeeding because of our beliefs in our mission, our team, and in ourselves. So we moved into Apollo. We were in the console Friday afternoon, January 27, 1967. We're about 1 month from launch testing the Apollo Command and Service Module. Crew members were Gus Gerson, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. We had worked with Gus and Ed and Mercury of the Gemini program. And Roger was a Navy rookie preparing for his first spaceflight, but he was already pretty well known because he was the pilot of the plane that put the pictures over Cuba during the missile crisis. The test that Friday hadn't been going very well. We had problems with communication, problems with life support. Test procedures were out of whack. We ran out the new test sequence, voice it to the test conductor at the gate with the crew on board the spacecraft. And we continued on. And at 6:31 that afternoon, we were surrounded by screams coming from our crew, and we listened to our crew's screams as they died. With their death in anger. Angered ourselves because we knew we were responsible for America's first space disaster. And we wrote two more words into our vocabularies and controllers, tough and competent. Tough meaning we will never again shirk from our responsibility because we're forever accountable for what we do, or in the case of Apollo 1, what we failed to do. Competent, we'll never again take anything for granted. We will never stop learning from now on the teams and mission control will be perfect. We designed a badge, the info of the mission control team, a price for admission to our ranks, or the simple lapel pin. Discipline, morale, toughness, confidence, commitment, teamwork. Because as a team, we must never fail. Now, our business, the boss is a flight director. He has a very simple job description. It is only 1 sentence long. And it says, the flight director may take any action needed for crew safety and mission success. That's it. During the course of a mission, there is no higher authority. And the flight director is supported by a team of between 15 and 21 controllers. People specialize in trajectory and spacecraft systems. We have facility operators, planners, schedulers, procedures writers. We have a medical doctor who looks after the ground team as well as the crew in space. And we have an astronaut who provides communications during the course of the mission. Mission controllers, the young, they're generally in their early to the mid-20s. Flight directors are in their early to the mid-30s. And this team on the screen right now, whose average age is 26, is the team that on July 20th, 1969, put Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and the world to the surface of the moon. And we literally fought every step of the way to get there. When we finally shut the engine down on the lunar surface that day, we had less than 17 seconds of fuel remaining, and we were in the process of cutting down to a very difficult and risky land abort decision. But when we shut that engine down and the crew walked on the surface, and when they lifted off and we got those guys back home, we had fulfilled the pledge that we had made for now then President John F. Kennedy and the crew of Apollo 1. We launched again in November, Apollo 12, as we left the launch pad, we were hit twice by lightning. We had three crewmen inside of that spacecraft thundering up towards orbit. The only thing working was booster guidance and the booster propulsion system. Mission Control had 2 minutes to save that mission. We voiced the instructions up to the crew to throw a very obscure switch that would restore our telemetry. With the telemetry back online, the control team could get to work. Voiced the instructions up to the crew to verify reactants were flowing into the fuel cells. We brought the fuel cells back online and the power system. We secured the navigation system. Everything kept working. Got the crew up in order. We delayed injection to the moon by 1 rev that day to check out the spacecraft as thoroughly as we possibly could. And then in a gutsy move, we decided we'd go for it. By the time we got to Apollo 13, this was our third lunar landing mission. The previous two missions had been pretty sporty, and we were hoping for a change. Something in this mission would go smoothly for us. Our crew members were Jim Lowell, Fred Hayes, and Ken Mattingly. Lowell and Hayes were the crew of the lunar module. They were scheduled to descend to the very rugged landing site on the moon that we called Palmaro. Ken Mattingly was the command module pilot. He remained circling the moon in a mothership. 2 days prior to launch, Mattingly was struck from the mission because he had been exposed to measles and is replaced by Jack Swigert, a member of the backup group. Now, missions run in thrust. When you turn 7.5 million pounds of thrust loose, that's a commitment. No change in your mind, and there's no more turning back. And thrust relay allows us to make the split second decisions we need very rapidly, seek out every option that may exist. We lost an engine during the second stage of powered flight. Very quickly, we looked at the remaining 4 engines. They were all go. We computed the new engine shutdown times, passed them up to the crew. Everything kept working. They got up in orbit. Checked the spacecraft app over the next 2.5 hours. And then we give the go for translunar injection. So now, by the end of the second day, this crew is 200,000 miles from Earth. They're 50,000 miles from the surface. And we're entering a phase of the mission, we use the term entering the lunar sphere of influence. And this is the point of the mission where you cross over from the Earth's gravity to the moon's gravity. And for a short period of time of about 4 hours, you have 2 mission abort options. One comes around the front side of the moon, takes about a day and a half to return to Earth. The other one goes completely around the moon, takes between 3.5 and 4 days to get back home. Got to make up your mind quick because time in these options is running out. My team was on the console. We were just finishing our second shift. Everything was looking pretty good, both on board the spacecraft and during the course of the mission. During my shift, we had had a television broadcast from the crew. During the broadcast, our wives and families had been sitting behind me in the viewing room. When the television broadcast was concluded, families went home and they turned the lights out in the room directly behind me. Now, in my main control room, my noise level was building up because the next team of controllers had reported in for shift handover. And their flight director, who was Glenn Lunny, who was the leader of the black team, who was sitting next to me at the console reading my log, writing out his handover questions. The final thing my team had to do was put the crew to sleep. We have a 5-page pre-sleep checklist we go through very carefully to make sure everything's properly configured on board the spacecraft. And we're down to the final entry. And this final entry asks a question: do we require a cryo stir? Now, the fuels that we use on board the spacecraft are cryogenic oxygen and hydrogen. Super dense, super cold, liquid packed in vacuum insulated tanks at incredibly low temperatures of minus 300 to 400 degrees Fahrenheit. These cryogenics react with the catalyst of the fuel cell to produce electricity. And as a byproduct of that reaction, they produce heat and pure water. So this is the energy, heat, and water resource we need to go to the moon, operate around the moon, and then return to Earth. So they're enormously important. 2 days into the mission, however, if I could look inside one of those tanks, I would see a very thick, icy vapor. And like fog on Earth, it tends to stratify and develop in layers. So the designers put fans inside the tank. We would turn on to stir this mixture up to make it uniform so we could measure it. And we had a heater that we used to raise the pressure. And this is what a cryostir was all about. Fans on, heater on. Jack Swigert, the command module, acknowledged our request for the stir. And he looked behind him, coming through the tunnel from the lunar module, was Fred Hayes. Swigert threw 2 switches. Now, nothing happened for 16 seconds. And then inside oxygen tank 2, a spark jumps between the fan and the heater assembly. And the pressure in that tank rises very rapidly over the next 6 seconds until it blows the dome of the tank off. When the dome came off, the insulation surrounding the tank caught fire. And fed by the oxygen, it was like a blowtorch racing through the bay of the spacecraft, drained out the instrumentation and the plumbing and the electrical systems, and shocking wells closed until the pressure increased to the point where it blew the side of the spacecraft off. And when the side came off, the area surrounding the spacecraft was engulfed in a cloud of debris from the explosion and frozen particles of oxygen. And this cloud of debris would follow us all the way to the moon until we moved it away from it. And we did not know an explosion had occurred. 55 hours, 55 minutes, and 4 seconds to launch. I voiced it was going to lock in flight. We had a computer restart. Another controller calls out main bus underhole. Third one says antenna switch, and then down from the spacecraft blow calls, "Hey Houston, we got a problem." But I already had several problems reported to me. I was wondering which one of all was talking about. My controllers at that instant didn't know what to believe because none of their data made sense. The crew thought they had been hit by a meteor. Then we see the spacecraft start to tumble, so Lovell has to take over manual control so he can keep his antennas pointed back to Earth. And for about 60 seconds, my voice loops are literally chaotic with all the reports going in. But then the training kicked in. The controllers started working the problem. They started voicing instructions up to the crew to restore many of the lost functions. But all of the problems that remained by 3 minutes fall upon a single controller from the inside of your gut. And Psi has a system's responsibility for those things you need to stay alive in space. Power, oxygen, pressure, heat, water. But I can't work with Psi because his tumbling motion has momentarily overcome Lull's ability to control it. He's driving towards a condition we call gimbal lock. If this occurs, we're going to tumble our gyros. We lose our ability to point the spacecraft, perform maneuvers, communicate, find our way back to Earth. We'll literally be lost in space until we can go through the very time-consuming and complex process of reorienting our navigation system. And you're becoming increasingly desperate. You're working the blinding still right until it's happening. Plus 20 minutes, Lowell's looking outside his hatch window, and he says, "Hey, Houston, I see some kind of a gaseous substance out there. I believe we're venting our oxygen." All of a sudden, the pieces fit together. There had been an explosion in space with an enormous amount of power out there. When I reached my controllers, I described their feeling at that instant as if they were just popping off into a void. I was a fighter pilot. Fighter pilots might be used to learn looking into the eyes of a tiger. And this is the start of a very lonely feeling that you get when the only thought on your mind is survival and you're trying to find some way out of a box you're in. Fires a flight director, it's my job to lead. So I call my controllers up and say, "Okay, our flight controllers, settle down. Quit your guessing, let's start working this problem. Electrical bus A is still good, don't do anything to screw it up. A lunar module is attached, we're going to use that as a lifeboat. Now get me some backup people in here and get me more computing and communications resources. Plus 30 minutes. My boss, Chris Kraft, comes in just as we're starting a series of emergency power downs. We're trying to buy some time. And Lieber got comes to me and says, "Flat, I'd like to shut down fuel cells 1-3. I say, "Yes, I would better think about that a bit more." He says, "No, Flat, I think that's the only way we're going to stop these leaks." I say, "Sai, are you ready for your final option?" He says, "Yes, Flat, it's time." And we have 3 fuel cells on board the spacecraft that use these cryogenics to produce energy, heat, water, to the moon, around the moon, and return to Earth. And they're enormously important. But the problem is, once they're shut down, they can never be restarted. Very reluctantly, I agree with Psy. It's time to shut down to the fuel cells. We voice the instructions up to Jim Lovell of the spacecraft. We want to shut down fuel cells, and the discussion with Jim is very short. It's very intense. And also very reluctantly, he shuts down to the fuel cells. And this is probably the lowest point of morale in the entire mission, because now we know there's no more going to the moon. We also know it's going to be damn tough, maybe impossible, to get this spacecraft home. I got through a decision yet because I have to pick the return path. As I said, I'm in this lunar sphere of influence, and I have 2 return options. If I jettison the lunar module and use the big engine, I can be home in about 36 hours. But something, some gut feeling, and that's all it is, because I don't have any data, so just don't use the engine. It won't work. The other option, I'm going to have to go completely around the moon. It's going to take between 3.5 to 4 days. And to the best of my knowledge, I have only enough electrical power in 2 days to 2 people. And with nothing more than a gut feeling, I make the decision to swing this mission around the moon. Call my controllers up and say, okay, all flight controllers, listen up. Be advised that all mission planning from now on will be around the moon. We will not, I repeat, we will not exceed a direct report. And this comes as a shock to these young kids, because many of them believe this is the wrong decision. But they also know it's decision time, and they're the ones that must execute it. We wish up the Lovell that we're going around the moon, and Lovell's response is simply, okay. And this mission's running in trust. Plus 1 hour, my team was finally accomplished handover to Glenn Lunny's team, and he's immediately challenged because the third fuel cell is now failing, and lifetime in that cell is down less than 15 minutes. So he scrambles the crew over to the lunar module to complete the power up, but most importantly, he has to transfer the navigation data, which is in the command module computer, and then die, and put it over in the lunar module computer. And all the computations for this data transfer, we didn't have a database capability in those days, there are all the computations. Pencil, the paper, the slide roll, and they must be perfect, and they must be done within the next 15 minutes. While Glenn's doing that, I'm walking downstairs where my Tiger team is warming up. As I walk downstairs, I think literally we're going to have to do in minutes and hours. It normally takes days and weeks. And we're going to be working outside all known design and test boundaries of the spacecraft. Walk into this room, crowded, noisy, smoky, a lot of confusion, and many people just came in from their respirator. And they haven't come on board yet. I walk up to the front of the room, and for the next 45 minutes, now up to an hour, we list the problems we expect to see. Batteries may freeze, water may freeze, propellants may freeze, large numbers, survival issues. How do we get back through the Earth's atmosphere? And it goes on and on and on. At the conclusion of drawing this list of must-dos, I give the team their name. We have never lost an American in space, and we sure as hell aren't going to lose one now. Failure is not an option. And to those young people, their direction was clear, and over the remaining 2.5 days, they would make it happen. We now focus, it's plus 2 hours, we now focus on the three most immediate problems: power, navigation, return trip time. John Ayer, a young 26-year-old engineer, very well depicted in the movie, is given the job to get us back home in the lunar module batteries. John stands up for the meeting, signs up to do the job, and he says, like, two things we're going to do immediately. I say, okay, John, what are they? And he says, well, he says, we've got to pay off the return trip. I say, okay, I'll work on that part of it. What's the other one? He says, well, we've got to power down the navigation system, displays, and computer. And I say, John, that one's not in the cards. And he says, why? Like, that's the biggest power user in the whole spacecraft. And I say, John, we normally navigate using stars, but with this debris cloud that is now surrounding the surrounding the spacecraft, we no longer can recognize stars. All we can clearly identify is the sun, the earth, and the moon. So Phil Schaffer, another one of my controllers, gets the job to come up with new ways to navigate and check our orientation before performing maneuvers, using only the sun, the earth, and the moon, and he has to get this done in the next 18 hours before the spacecraft passes behind. I take a third component of my team to come up with a way to get us home a day early. And the basic approach is this. As spacecraft passes behind the moon's gravity is going to pull us in an arc and point us back towards Earth. And at the proper place of that arc, I'm going to ignite the engine that I would have used to land on the moon. Only this time I'm going to use it to increase our forward speed by roughly about 1,000 feet per second. That way we'll have a day off return. Meanwhile, in the control room upstairs, Lunny's team has had the crew perform a very small maneuver. We haven't done anything. Just about 4 days from now, we would have gone around the moon, passed by Earth, missing it by 6,000 to 10,000 miles. And we have a mission rule that says we will never leave a crewman stranded in space. So now, with this small maneuver, we're bringing the spacecraft back to Earth so the crew is coming home, even though it's going to be too late. Now, the Soviet Union has been listening to our communications. They know we've got the Indian Ocean. And they know the United States Navy doesn't have any ships there, so they call us up, give us their ship locations, and offer their assistance in rescuing the crew. Literally, the entire world is now helping us to get this crew back home. We have our first press conference because the media believes that the crew is lost. And at the conclusion of the press conference, the media is given the opportunity to come over into Mission Control. We fabricate a small booth over in the left-hand corner of my room, patch in all the voice communications in it. So now everything that we do and everything that we say is being reported live to the entire world as it is happening. We're living in a fishbowl. We've accomplished a ship handover one more time in Mission Control. No Littler's room team has now. And things have settled down to the point now where we got time to talk to the crew and get their opinion and the direction that we're intending to take. But more importantly, we're looking at the events leading up to and after the explosion, trying to figure out what on board the damaged spacecraft will be useful in coming up with our return plan. Plus 24 hours, we've figured out how to navigate using Sun, Earth, and Moon. Power management plan is in work. Got the get home fast maneuver on board the spacecraft. And as maneuver time approaches, it gets real quiet in Mission Control. My controllers are on shore, their consoles are very tight, limits upon all the propulsion parameters. Then we hear the crew call out engine start. And the engine's fish statement, now steering properly. And I say, hey, Brock, what the hell is going on? He says, give it a few more seconds, like this is what. And this engine settles down, starts thrusting correctly, and continues burning for the next 4.5 minutes. And then the crew calls shutdown. And then they start their post-burn report. And we immediately recognize our mistake. When we computed the trim for the engine to be in at the start of the maneuver, we assumed two crewmen would be in the lunar module and one crewman would be in the command module. Well, that assumption was wrong because they had all three crowded into the lunar module so they could see what was going on. So from now on in Mission Control, there will be no more assumptions. Well, the maneuver did cut a day off the return journey. It also changed our landing point. We're now going to land in the South Pacific just to the east of Samoa. So we sent the aircraft carrier Iwo Jima to the landing location. Now the only management flap, the Apollo 13, begins. Pete Slayton is the boss of the astronaut, pretty tough customer. Comes up to me at the console and leans over and he says, look, I want you to get my crew to sleep. They're too damn tired. They're going to make a mistake. And about the time I got his input, my boss, Chris Kraft, gets me in the other side. He said, nope, he said, you're using too much power. I want you to get that spacecraft powered down. The guy standing behind Kraft is Max Vigier, chief of engineering. And Max said, nope, don't listen to those two. What you gotta do is you gotta restore thermal balance to the spacecraft. Well, that was the track I was already going down because we'd been tracking the temperatures of the spacecraft in the previous 24 hours. And on the sun side of the spacecraft, the temperature was plus 150. On the dark side, the opposite side, it was minus 180. So we had a 333 temperature difference from one side of the spacecraft to the opposite side of the spacecraft. And everything on the dark side was freezing up rock solid. Now we have no source of energy except the sun. So what we must do is invent a barbecue type maneuver to spin the spacecraft perfectly on its axis so the sun can heat all sides. We've never done this before using the lunar module thrusters. Probably one of the finest examples of real-time teamwork that I've ever seen. Kneeling down with me in this picture here are the designers of the autopilot system, standing up are my own controllers. And for about 45 minutes to an hour period of time, we're literally conducting a physics experiment in space. We're trying to figure out which thruster, for such a thruster, for combinations of thrusters fired in which direction for how long will cause this spin-up condition to be. We work for about an hour. We finally feel we got all the piece parts of the procedures. We call a halt for testing, write the sequence up, then voice it up to the crew. The crew executes it, and it doesn't work. Look back at the procedure, we're convinced it's right, but they must have missed one of the steps, so we tell them to try it one more time, and this time it works like a champ. The spacecraft is now spinning perfectly on its axis. The sun is now starting to heat all sides of the spacecraft. Now we can fully power down the spacecraft. We bring it down to a level of about 100 watts, much less than that light bulb over there is using, which is just enough to operate a small fan to circulate the atmosphere. atmosphere in the spacecraft and provide power for our communications. And we know it's going to get as cold as a meat locker on board the spacecraft. We can also go off and get some rest because we've been operating pretty close to 50 hours by this time. While we're resting, engineering comes up with a solution to another problem because our crew is slowly suffocating. We have run out of the cylindrical air scrubbers containing a chemical called lithium hydroxide to remove the carbon dioxide from the crew's breathing when we recirculate the air. So the carbon dioxide partial pressure is building up and the crew is about 10 hours from suffocation. We have plenty of squirt scrubbers, however, over in the bed and ram up. So we come up with a way to fabricate an adapter to get the squirt scrubbers into the ram hole made out of a cardboard cover from the flight plan, big plastic baggie we have on board, we use a sock as a filter, some hoses, some more cardboard tied together with duct tape. That's the sketch of the original fix. Build one of these guys, put it online in the laboratories, it works like a champ, so we send instructions up to the crew to fabricate one of these, and at the time this came online, they had less than 5 hours of time remaining before they just succeeded. By the time this device is online, my team comes back in from our rest period, and our return status is not very encouraging. It's getting much colder in the spacecraft than we expected it to. And our water system is starting to freeze up, so we have the crew transferring the water to baggies so they have something to rehydrate their food. The Navy tells me a Typhoon is building in the exact landing area and bringing the spacecraft back to. And they want me to change my landing site. But the one problem that really gets my attention is my trajectory team tells me we're going to miss the Earth. We're going to skip out of trajectory. Now, when we fly back to Earth, we have to fly down a 2.5 degree wide cone-shaped corridor. If we come in too shallow, we'll skip off the Earth's atmosphere, just like a stone does off water. And we will go into a high eternal orbit between the Earth and the Moon. We'll never come home. If you come in too steep, we're going to burn up in about 45 to 60 seconds, just like Columbia did during its trajectory. So we really got to thread that return path. Now we have no computer, we have no display system, but we have figured out a way to perform a maneuver. We tell the crew to rotate the spacecraft so they can see the Earth outside the two triangular windows in the lunar module. And on each one of these windows is a gun sight type device with the center crosshairs we use for lunar rendezvous and during for navigation and docking. And we tell the crew to align the y-axis crosshair on the Earth's terminator, which is aligned between daylight and darkness. And in this orientation, the engine will be properly positioned to correct our trajectory. We then say, Jim, looking through your telescope at the Earth, when the engine starts, you use your hand controller and steer so the Earth does not go up and down in your window. We say, Fred Hayes, over your side of the spacecraft, with your telescope and your hand controller, you steer the spacecraft to keep the Earth from going from left to right. Then we tell Jack Spire to put 14 seconds in his wristwatch, and that is the entire procedure. That's all there is to it. Crew talks it over amongst themselves for a few minutes. And we hear them call out, engine start, and they're all over the place for these first few seconds, but they catch on to this control technique pretty quick. 14 seconds later, we hear shutdown, and then we track them for a half hour, and doggone it, this maneuver technique didn't get them right back within the proper reentry corridor. Now, for the next 24 hours, the crew doesn't have anything to do except watch the Earth grow larger and larger and larger. Spacecraft windows. On mission control, I feel I'm running out of time, and here's basically my problem. Now, this is a picture of a model from my office. On the left hand side is a lunar model. This is our lifeboat. Everything we need to stay alive, communication space, providing the spinning motion to keep the systems from freezing up. The center part is the command module. That's a cone shaped vehicle. It's our re entry vessel. It has the only heat shield, but it only has about 2 hours of electrical power life. On the far right is the service module where the explosion occurred. Now, at the very last moment, as we're entering into the Earth's atmosphere, I have to separate these three pieces explosively at different times on different trajectories. But before I do that, I have to evacuate from the lunar module, leaving it controlling the orientation, get into the command module, rapidly and efficiently power that guy up, initialize the computer, close the match, and then start blowing pieces of permanent. This is going to turn into a checklist that is about 500 steps long, and this is one page from the checklist. This is what our procedures look like on every day. And you notice in the upper right-hand corner, we have very simple configuration management. We just identify the time the last change was made, and when we made a new one, smack out that one, put the new one down. We made 4 changes to that checklist. That's just one page from the almost 40 that we had during the Apollo 13 chapter. It's now time to start voicing the instructions up to the crew. For these procedures, we're down to landing minus 18. We get Jack Swigert and work with him for about 2 hours of what he must do in the command module. He reads the procedures back to us. We believe he understands what must be done when we start working with Fred Hayes. And working with Fred Hayes is tough because he just doesn't seem to be on top of his communication. He now has uncontrollable shivers. Both crewmen are hugging and trying to get some body heat info. Body temperature is about 105 degrees, severely dehydrated, bad urinary infection, but Fred is the one that must execute the job in the lunar module. So we keep working with Fred until he understands his part of the job, and we power down to get a few hours of rest before we come in for our final shift. We're now down to landing minus 8. And I always have my controllers go through what I call psycho. Put on their mission case. They get off by themselves, get focused upon their job, their objective, what must be done. Come back into the control room, give me a green indicator from their console. When I have an all green board, I send my flight surgeon around to interview the controllers, talk to them, to see if they're going to need a stimulant to keep them going for these final 8 hours. Virtually all the controllers refuse. They're going to make it from black coffee and cigarettes. I put on this white vest, which has been my team's trademark since the very early days in space. And I pull my controllers from the start of the ship's status, and they report in, and they're sharp, they're crisp, they're on top of the job. I'm damn proud of these guys, they can crook. And then I get concerned now, I'm going to peak too soon, it's the adrenaline. Don't even have that luxury. My trajectory controller comes from me, he says, "Light, I hate to tell you this, we're going to miss the Earth. We must perform an emergency maneuver." Now we have to use some of our very precious electrical power we've been hoarding. We voice the instructions up to the crew to power up the guidance computer. Tell them what program we want loaded, and they load their own program. And in those days, it was really tough to recover from a bad procedure using the computer. Finally get that sorted out. Voice the instructions up for the orientation we want for the maneuver, and they load that in correctly. And it's obvious this crew is just hanging on there. And their guardian angel from now on is Joe Kermit. These are my two communicators from the final ship. Ken Mattingly on the left asked about his start from mission. Joe Kermit in the white shirt, who's my primary communicator. He's a medical doctor. He'll be the first doctor in space on the Skylab 2 mission. And Joe's bedside manner with this crew during his final 8 hours is absolutely spectacular. Time to jettison the damaged service module. Crew calls off service module jettison, and there's a 45-second pause as they maneuver into position to take some more photographs. Then we start getting the voice reports. Okay, got it. The whole side of the spacecraft is missing all the way to the high gain antenna. The whole side is missing to the base of the engine. And he says, "Yeah, got the engine too. There's nothing out there but a dark brown streak by the injector." And in mission control, I'm thinking of this decision that I made almost 3.5 days earlier, based on nothing but a gut feeling, and I cannot describe to you how intense that feeling was. And many of the controllers have experienced this during their career. There's some point in the mission where you've done absolutely the best you can for your crew and your mission, and now it's time to turn over to a higher authority to bring this mission to its ultimate conclusion. We now continue the process of powering up the command module. There's water all over the inside of the spacecraft. From the switches and circuit breakers and the light bulbs, blobs as big as a silver dollar floating free in the air. And as each one of these systems comes alive, they were never designed to be put into a deep freeze, and they come alive, the controllers are absolutely astounded. We initialize the computer, we watch it integrating a proper trajectory back down to Earth. And mission control in this final hour, these controllers are sensing victory, and you can feel this cockiness building up within the room. Also know that one slip, we can lose the emotional content of the room continues to build because as we go to our lunar mother, we speak to him. We say, farewell, Aquarius. We thank you. You're one hell of a good ship. We blow the explosive bolts, and that's when the sun rays are going to disintegrate before it gets to the city. And now it's time for me to run my final poll. And just as I'm starting to run this final poll, controller comes to me and says, Mike, we got to get the crew quick. Battery seat's failing. We don't want them to make a mistake now. We need power for the parachutes. And we voice the instructions to the crew to pull battery seat offline. We redistribute the power with the two remaining batteries to make sure we got power for the parachutes. We finally get this sorted out. And it's awfully tough to talk right now because the rookie on board the spacecraft finally calls down and says, you know, I was up here. I want to thank you guys down there for the great job you did. And then we get an attaboy from both Lovell and Hayes. And before we can respond, there's a person static. They get called flight. You've had a loss of signal. We're in blackout. Mm-hmm. And blackout is the time period where the parametric prevents our communications from the spacecraft. At this stage in the space program, we can compute when blackout will start and when it will stop in a second, and we know this. And blackout is very difficult for every controller because there's only one spot in every controller flying. Did I get to prove everything I needed to? Was my data right? Because from now on, there are no more readbacks. This is Milt Windler, Marine Flight Director during Apollo 13. These are the bosses and the Royal Consuls directly behind me. And every eye is at the clock on the wall counting down to zero. When it finally hits zero, the blackout should be over. And I still see the opening call. The girl calls out, say, Houston, standing by. And there's no response from the crew. All we hear is static. We call again, we call again, we call again, and it's now 1 minute since we should heard from the crew. And literally every controller, mission control, is now standing, staring at this platform. What the hell went wrong? In our business, we will never surrender. So we keep calling, we keep working. 1 minute and 27 seconds later, a downrange aircraft calls out our I-4 his acquisition signal. And then the aircraft carrier reports a sonic boom, then they report radar contact, and then mission control, we see this beautiful picture of the spacecraft. One of these three red and white parachutes, and the emotional release from that instant is so intense that every controller is standing crying. You're frankly embarrassed by your loss of composure. You pull yourself together, you get back to work, sit down at the console. Spacecraft hits the water, remains upright, and then the aircraft carrier Iwo Jima continues to circle the spacecraft. He deploys more helicopter, the parajumpers go in the water. And now this crew that has been living in the meanwhile, the temperatures inside the spacecraft range from 35 to 37, extremely humid, and all they had was a white cotton cover off. Now these guys are out in the warm air of the South Pacific, and they are home, and they are alive. Now our business, our job is not over. Until we hand over responsibility for this crew to the Recovery Task Force Commander, and as soon as the crew's feet hit that carrier deck, we start that handover process. And when it's complete, and only when it's complete, do we start our celebration. By now, I have pre-positioned 700 of the finest cigars I can find. From the West Coast to the East Coast, they range from factories, offices, laboratories, and on the national TV, I count down the light of the skies up. Probably the sweetest smoke that any of us ever had. You know, I wonder today, since they can't smoke in mission control, what they're going to do when they celebrate some victory over a very difficult time. Second phase in our celebration is back out of the condition we call battle circle. During all critical mission phases, we physically block all power breakers in the building so they won't get inadvertently open, and we lock all doors. Now we back out of the battle circle condition, and our backroom controllers come in and join us. And these folks are the real heroes on 13 because they're the ones that gave us the answers we needed when we needed them. All we did in the main control room was to have cadence. And some of the pieces they gave us here in the proper sequence. Third phase of celebration is a tradition that we started when we set America's first spaceflight record and carry it all the way through the Skylab into the early shuttle program. We pass out an American flag to every controller. And on the staff of that flag, you write your mission, you write your name, your job, your ability.
Each of us has a pump of those guys about 8 to 10 inches in diameter, and we'd never give one of those guys away. But President Nixon came down and visited with the controllers in Houston, then went out to recognize the crew's performance out in Hawaii. And there's not enough I can say about what these guys did, because they were truly heroic under extremely difficult circumstances for a very long period of time. Performance was superb. A few words about my flight directors. We always operate the short flight control teams. We did this to balance the training along the workload, because training is very intense as we approach mission time, and four teams let us spread the workload of training and during the mission phases, so we were quite bad physically and emotionally when the mission time came around. Second thing is our ship turret lines are relatively long. They're generally 14 to 16 hours each day. And this is because we have 8-hour shift, 2-hour standover, press conference, then we come back in from the first shift of the team that replaces. Maybe the most important reason, however, is before a mission ever starts. We have one team that's designated as a crisis management team. And that happened to be my responsibility for all 13. Prior to launch, I was designated as lead flight director. And if a problem occurred, it was up to me to get my team out of the rotation sequence and then come up with the solutions to whatever problems we had, returning back to the console only to execute those procedures. Glenn Lunny was the, on the left, is the youngest of the flight directors. He was 32 at the time of Apollo 13. Came to us from Case Institute in Cleveland, a team colored black. First person I ever worked with that had tinkered with computers. So when it came time to work with machines for the answers we needed for this mission, he was my go-to guy. I was the oldest of the flight directors at 37, team colored white, Milt Wimpler, team colored maroon, Jerry Griffin Gold. The remaining three of us were all fighter pilots, and Milton and I flew the F-86 Sabre, and Jerry Griffin flew the Boot. I believe it was, living with the risks of jet aviation, and military jet aviation, that really allowed us to keep our poise with the very young people that we had on our teams. Our nation abandoned the moon in December 1972. For us, this was a marvelous time to live, because we believed in this dream that we were given by John F. Kennedy. We considered ourselves privileged and proud to be part of the brotherhood that formed in the early years of space flight. And we thanked our country every day that they gave us a chance to be part of this spectacular adventure. So this is the story of Apollo 13, story of mission control, story of teams that are tied together through leadership, trust, values, and teamwork. And I'm sure you experienced many of the same characteristics as schedulers and dispatchers, because much of your work is suffered from that which you do. And success in our work depends upon absolute dedication and commitment to those people who have the responsibility to execute flight operations. So I thank you for the opportunity to come and speak to you today. And I wish you luck in your continuing meetings here. We have what we call, I won't say re-blue, the patient peace controller goes through extended periods of time of retraining to come back up to speed and do procedures, sir. So I believe that we all understand what you're going through over the next several days. So good luck in your training. And again, thank you.